This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome all to the Joan B. Kroc School of Peace Studies here at the University of San Diego. This evening's lecture by Asi Barak will serve both as an exciting and thought-provoking standalone event. It also kicks off an event we're calling the California Consensus, or CalCon, for Peace and Security, Peace Through Technology, which really gets underway tomorrow. We've got a sort of action-packed day. The basic idea is to bring together promising peace and conflict researchers, wherever they may be in the world, funders, technologists, and policymakers, to make rapidly responsive and policy-relevant peace research more of a reality than it is today. The theme this hopefully inaugural year is challenging violent movements. So I want to extend a warm welcome to all of you, whether you come from the wider community or as an attendee of the California Consensus. So the California Consensus will be focusing on how technology can sharpen the agenda and quicken the response times of peace research. My profession, economics, is often vilified as basically a bunch of soulless human computers, and we tally up the utility of a certain amount of justice, and then we compare that to a certain number of pairs of socks or something like that. We can make some equation between the two. Johann Galtung, one of the founding fathers of peace studies, once visited here about 5 years ago, and he lightheartedly told me that the best part about being an economist was that I could always become an ex-economist. And so in that one little flippant remark, basically implied that I wasted the last 10 or 12 years of my life. And yet, economists have really begun to make great contributions to peace research, especially in three specific areas. So one, that's analyses of the economic costs of conflict and the benefits of peace. These analyses can be used to inform policymakers of the scale of a particular problem, and therefore what sort of resources we should be thinking about devoting to these problems. A recent report that came out last week, many of you will be familiar with, from the Peace and Security Funders Group, let us know that less than 1% of all global foundation grants go toward peace and security issues. And largely that may be a function of us not doing a very good job of saying that this matters in the first place. Two, analyses of what causal factors contribute to the initiation, continuation, or termination of violent conflict. So these studies often direct the broad strategies for policy response. So what are the pressure points of a conflict? And what are the likely results of eliminating this or that factor? And finally, something that is seen as increasingly sexy and trendy over the past 5 or 10 years, evaluations of peace-building interventions. These have, in some cases, become very sophisticated enterprises with randomized control and treatment groups for various combinations of intervention factors, as well as dose-response assessments. Done correctly, these studies are able to determine the economic benefits of the actual intervention chosen, which can then be compared to the cost of the intervention itself to see if the net benefit is comparable to other alternatives or even just to the status quo of doing absolutely nothing. Economists and peace researchers more broadly generally do not have the tools for A, creatively crafting an effective intervention in the first place, and B, perhaps even more importantly, reshaping the cultural landscape and the political context in which peace-building interventions are valorized, supported, and funded, or not. This larger social context may determine the very calculus governing the decisions made by peacemakers and those supporting peace-building processes. Our guest tonight has substantial experience in raising popular awareness of peace and social justice issues, and thereby galvanizing the support needed, both to fund interventions and to pressure and empower political leaders to actually act. And his tool, as you know by now, is the video game. Tonight, we are privileged to welcome Asi Barak. He's an award-winning game creator, tech executive, and social entrepreneur. Until recently, Asi served as the president of Games for Change, a nonprofit with a mission to catalyze social impact through digital games. Games for Change produces the annual Games for Change Festival, which is the largest gaming event in New York City, and now part of the Tribeca Film Festival. Major funders include the Ford Foundation, Zynga.org, USAID, the UN Foundation, NEA, and the Packard Foundation. Asi works closely with organizations that are actively pursuing digital games to further their public or corporate social responsibility missions. For clients including USAID, the World Bank, the American Museum of Natural History, the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof of Half the Sky fame, he has guided the investment of over $8 million into projects that have the potential to reach over 50 million people. As the executive producer of the Half the Sky movement game, Asi orchestrated partnerships with Zynga, some of the world's leading NGOs, and authors Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. The Facebook game has reached over 1.3 million players, last we checked, and generated nearly $500,000 in donations. Prior to Games for Change, Asi co-founded Impact Games, the creators of Peacemaker and Play the News. He's a faculty member at the School of Visual Arts, MFA in Design for Social Innovation, and holds a Master of Entertainment Technology from Carnegie Mellon University. Dee mentioned Joan Kroc. I was hired after her time, but it has become almost a legendary phrase of hers that this school was founded to make peace, not just study it. Were she here tonight with us, she would undoubtedly join me in asking you, ladies and gentlemen, to please welcome to the stage Asi Barak.
Hi, everyone. We have a few pieces of technology to make sure that, you know, they all align and everything is going to work for us. I see some familiar faces already. So I want to speak about video games today, and I want to speak about power and responsibility. I want to speak about one of the most powerful tools in our possession today in terms of media. Arguably, especially with the young generation, it's the most dominant medium, and you know, time most spent on this medium, but at the same time, it's pretty young and it didn't reach the diversity of traditional media. And when I speak about diversity, is the idea that if you think about movies, if you think about books, if you think about theater, if you think even about dance, I mean, all these types of expression, they have a very diverse portfolio. And anyone can go and play them or feel them or watch them or listen to them. And it could be any age and gender and taste. And in video games, we're still at the very beginning. So this is how I want you to think about it. And what I'm going to show you today is the first period of evolution, okay? We're not in cave paintings, but we're not also in, you know, the golden age of video games. We're still at the very beginning. So I'll tell you first about my beginning, because I think in this context, especially of peace studies, it makes a lot of sense to talk about it. So I'm coming from a very small place in the world. It's so small that the red dot on the map covers like three neighboring countries. And it's also a conflict zone, as you all know. And that means that you live in a very specific environment, a very special place. Intense, and for better and worse, these are the types of things you're surrounded with. This is an authentic painting, drawing that I made when I was 5 years old. My mother was very diligent in saving those drawings from then. And I can compare it, you know, now I have kids at that age and I can compare to what they draw, you know, from princesses and rainbow unicorns or whatever. This is what I was drawing. You know, these are the symbols that went into my association world and expression. And then, you know, even if you try to avoid the conflict around you, which is very hard, by the way, because there's nothing more important than news. In Israel, current events news, this is the most important thing. It's always in the hierarchy in the newspaper, it's always above culture or sports or entertainment, no matter what. And every 30 minutes you have a breaking news broadcast on the radio. It's like you can't avoid. But let's say that you try to avoid it. Comes the age of 18, and then every male is going to do 3 mandatory years of service in the army, and women are doing 2. And I actually did 5, because I became an officer, I was a captain, and I went to the intelligence corps. And if you didn't recognize me, it's the guy on the right in that picture. And this is actually from the officer's course. And it was a very interesting experience because, and I think it's related to what I did later, because as an intelligence officer, everything you do is about the other side, okay, the other perspective. You become an expert in what the other side is thinking, you're trying to predict their actions, you're becoming an expert in their agenda and goals, and you become familiar with what you're doing much more than you're familiar with your own side and your own army. I didn't know much about the IDF, the Israeli army, but I knew everything I needed to know about the other side. And the other thing that is actually connected here is the fact that it was like a game. There was something about... I'll give you an example of what it means to be an intelligence officer. Something that I hope the Mossad is not going to kidnap me tonight after I'm telling you the example. Imagine that I'm going to let you view 10 emails. Let's say it like this. There are 10 emails that went between Donald Trump and his campaign manager. Okay? I'll just use that example because, you know. But I'm going to give you 5, okay? And also, I'm not going to give you 5 in sequence. I'm going to give you a random 5 emails. And the main reason is that objectively, this is what I could gather, okay? I could get only 5 out of the 10. You need to make the big picture. Now, what happens is that in some cases, you will miss context. In some cases, they know what they're talking about, and they'll say, you know, the short guy or the guy with the mustache or, you know, the guy that we met yesterday. And you need to kind of bring it all together and basically take this picture and broadcast it to the superiors, to the supervisors. So that's kind of the game. Now, it's a very interesting game, and you can get addicted very quickly. But it's also a bit of a meaningless game in the sense that after doing it for many years, you find out that you don't have big wins. You know, the wins that you have, you know, yeah, maybe you succeeded in saving lives for sure and preventing some event from happening, and maybe you helped to get out one of the big players on the other side, but then another one is coming in to replace him. So it's a constant. I mean, I realized at some point that nothing of the big changes is happening at that level, that the big changes happen in the leadership level. So the big things like the Oslo Agreement were completely surprising to us. You know, big moves like the Kuwait-Iraq war, number one, complete surprise. And you realize that game is really just tactics. It's not the real strategy of the conflict. So I left it all. I went to do some entertainment in Israel. You know, Israel has a very strong IT community. And back then, we did mobile applications and games. It was very early. We're talking about 2000. In the US, people didn't use data at all. So, you know, the whole idea that you're going to use the phone not to speak on the phone was kind of completely new. So our markets were actually Asia and Europe. And we had 10 operators that were using our very early groundbreaking software that let people find each other and date and get locations. So we did it even before GPS. So it was based on cell towers, you know, like 3 cell towers. So we could let you know the location like 500 meters, and in proximity. And by the way, that was urban areas. In other areas, it was much worse. And then something was missing, right? Like many of you, I guess, that when you're doing things that are not related to the social impact, you feel something is missing. And for me, this disconnect between what I'm doing, you know, flying every 2 weeks to another country, selling the mobile entertainment that I could do anywhere in the world, was very different than the reality that I was living in. So I went on a journey from one small place to another, and I came to Pittsburgh in 2004, and I came to Carnegie Mellon. Any idea who that guy is? Let's put a bookmark. I really recommend you to follow it if you have kind of 20 minutes. The last lecture by Randy Pausch became pretty known something like 10 years ago. He was my professor, and I met him in Carnegie Mellon. I was very lucky to come to that program that was all about right brain, left brain. So one of the first programs that said, you know, we'll take people that come from design and art, and we'll take people that come from computer science, and we'll put them together, and let's see what happens. And Randy Pausch, the last lecture, he came to fame in a very tragic way in the last 6 months of his life, because a doctor told him, his doctor told him that he's going to die, and he has a type of cancer that he cannot do anything to cure. And he went on and did in Carnegie Mellon the last lecture, much like this setting. Someone took it on video, put it online, it became hugely viral. And the reason is that he was so optimistic. He was 46. He basically said, at the age of 46, I achieved all my childhood dreams. And I know what's coming. I know what I'm about to experience. All I care about is spending the time with my family. But in terms of my career and, you know, life, I feel very satisfied. So I'm meeting Randy Pausch. That was kind of a couple of years before all of this story, and it was one of the best teachers I ever had. And already on the first day, so imagine the context, right? I was 5 years in the army, I was an executive in Israel in a startup, all the kids are 23, and I'm like 33. So I'm already like 10 years older, and they give this opportunity to pitch your own project. So like people are going to do tomorrow. So you can either take the project that the faculty gives you, and some of them are really lucrative. You know, you go and work with Disney or a game company, or you can do your own. So first day that I'm coming to Carnegie Mellon, God knows how I came to this idea. I want to make a video game about the Middle East conflict. That's the response. I mean, you know, it's very interesting, but how a group of students can, you know, take on something so ambitious, so big. You never made video games before. It's so complex. It's, by the way, also, even now the perception of video games is much better than it was in 2004. Back then it was Grand Theft Auto. Politicians were talking, even Hillary Clinton, by the way, was speaking publicly against video games, against the damage that they do to young generations. And there was something intriguing in it, and they let us try it. So I think part of it, because I was much older, they said, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe he has some experience that will help. They let us experiment with it. And I actually dedicated all my studies with a team of students to make this game. And not only that we made the Peacemaker the student project, we actually took it out to the world after that. We spun off a company. So hopefully that will happen also tomorrow at the pitch, that some of those ideas will grow up to be companies. And we sold it around the world. We self-published it because, you know, every publisher told us, oh, it's very interesting, but we can't touch it. It's political. It's crazy. I'm going to show you a video now about Peacemaker so you see a bit. But to give you a few clues for the video, we got crazy press because you could imagine a group of students in Carnegie Mellon making a game about peace in the time of Grand Theft Auto, that's a great story, right? It's like the inversion of everything people think about video games. The thing is that we got that press so early that the faculty started to get really stressed out. Are we going to even finish this thing that everybody is talking about? So what you'll see in the video is like ABC and Al Jazeera that sent a special crew to Pittsburgh from Qatar, and craziness like this. And we're like, you know, we have like a prototype that hardly works. And and eventually we finished it. And other things to notice, it's a game in three languages. So we made it sure that it's in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And it has two sides. You'll see it also in the video. You can play the Israeli side or the Palestinian side. Very different. So that was one of the big ideas. And the last piece is it's all real footage. So everything that you'll see in the game, we actually decided to use real footage from Reuters, whether it's videos or pictures. And it was very new and back then in the gaming industry to do something like this. So let me show you the video and then we'll continue.
Peacemaker is a game in which you take the role of one of the leaders. You can take either the role of the Israeli Prime Minister or the Palestinian President. You can play both perspectives. And the idea is that as the leader, you have to react to real-time events happening in the world. You can negotiate with other leaders, but you also have security or military actions that you can take. And by doing so, you have to reach a peaceful solution while in office.
In an Israeli high school, a new computer game called Peacemaker was launched today. Children playing the role of Israeli and Palestinian leaders trying to make peace in a virtual world of suicide bombings and Israeli military strikes.
We don't expect to address all issues of the conflict. We don't expect to give all the answers. We're bringing up issues for discussion.
I think the best aspect of playing this game is that, especially if you're Palestinian student in the territories or an Israeli student within Israel, you get a chance to really feel what both sides are thinking and get a better sense of what they can do together to work towards peace.
If you look at the video game industry today, there are so many games out there about violence, about war, about destructions. We say a simple thing: there is certainly a place for one little game about peace.
So this is when I was young and naive. Seriously, in this setting, we could stay on Peacemaker for the whole talk. I mean, it's, as you can imagine, it's such an experience. And, you know, just to see the responses of people and people we tested with and customers and, you know, communities. But I want to tell you two quick stories. One is, you saw him in the video, Danny Atom. I spoke with some of the students this morning about this, and I tried not to spoil the story. But Danny Atom was the ex-head of Mossad in Israel. And at that time, when we published the game, he was running for to be the number one on the Labor Party and run to be prime minister. For whatever reason, he agreed to play Peacemaker in front of the camera on prime time. In the biggest Israeli channel. And what happens is, by the way, I have the video, I can send you a link, but just to tell you this quickly the story, he was basically playing the game, there was a camera over the shoulder showing everything that he does, and he also narrated. So it's like, what we did is, we have what we call an inciting incident. So when you start Peacemaker, in whatever side you do it, you get this very violent event, because we wanted to get you into this mindset right from the beginning that it's not this kumbaya, you know, everything is, it's like very realistic and you're going to face violence. And he saw the suicide bomb, and then he starts in a series of the most harsh military responses you can imagine. Like, I'm going with Apache strike. Great, we show them. And it's like, really, I mean, maybe because he was on TV, he had to do this thing, and just like one after the other. And then the reporter is like, you know, raising his hand. Is maybe diplomacy, you know, maybe we'll try something. So he's looking at the diplomacy menu, and then he's like, oh, great, let's do demand concessions. And then it takes him 5 minutes to lose the game. The losing scenario that jumped on the screen is the third intifada. And then he's like, he's a bit in shock, and then he says, well, I lost because the computer told me I lost. But this game is completely unrealistic because I did all the right things. So that's when we understood that politicians are not going to be our audience, and, you know, it's a lost cause, and we should go for maybe the young generation is still, you know, still prone to influence. And that story that I want to tell you is probably the best thing that happened to Peacemaker. And it's also a lesson that I learned for the future that, you know, making an interesting game is one thing, but finding a way to get it to the hands of people is sometimes not less important. We made this very creative deal with the Peres Center. You know, this is the NGO in Israel that was founded by Shimon Peres, that was the president. And I think it's 15 years old, and back then they did a lot of work that they still do with the communities in Israel and the West Bank. And they bought from us 100,000 copies of Peacemaker. So we actually shipped them from the U.S. in a big ship. And they actually get like physical CDs. That was back then. And what they did, they took 80,000 of those and they put them in the newspaper in both Israel in Haaretz and in Al-Quds in the West Bank for subscribers. So people that were subscribers to both papers, they opened the newspaper in the morning and got a free CD of Peacemaker. And that was, as you can imagine, it was a big stunt, and it was in the day of one of the peace summits, and it was like a talk of the day. You know, it's a very small country. The second thing they did, with the 20,000 that were left, they started to run those workshops. And that was super interesting to see, and they ran them for years. I think they're still running them. And I was witness of one of those workshops in Israel, and it was in a suburb of Tel Aviv, a very place of very educated youth and, you know, people that are next year in the army. And what that experiment revealed to me is the level of ignorance and how much this is not dealt with in the education system, and how Peacemaker, regardless of the impact of the game itself, of, you know, about perspectives and understanding, even just as a trigger for discussion, it had an amazing role. And to have people sitting in the classroom and for the first time dealing with it, because it's completely outside of the system and something that people are trying not to touch, and the game was a trigger, but it was also a safe environment because they were playing roles and they could tell each other, you know, when I was the prime minister, this is what I did. So it's not really me, it's like a role I played. And it was a very interesting thing to see. So we're only finished with Act 1. I'm going to do Act 2 pretty quickly. That's the idea of how do you go from one game to a movement. So I was very lucky to join, after a few years that I was running my own company, to lead Games for Change, which is the movement for Games for Social Impact. And that's my inspiration. Art Spiegelman in 92 writes a comic book about the Holocaust. And think about it, taking a medium that suffered from similar perception and, you know, that it's very shallow and it can't be serious, you can't do... And he tells the most profound, serious story of his life, the story of his father and World War II. He wins the Pulitzer Prize, so it becomes a financial success, and it changes the whole medium. So there are many followers to what Art Spiegelman did, and now suddenly we call those comic books graphic novels. So even the name changed because comic books cannot contain anymore, you know, the seriousness of this. And you will go now to any bookstore or on Amazon and you'll find graphic novels about anything, you know, conflict zones and personal stories of people coming from Iran. I just read one about childhood in Libya. So very interesting, and that was always something I looked at. And One way to create a movement is by creating events, right? So we had this festival, and one thing we were very successful with is bringing all those speakers that will never show up in a gaming conference, right? And the other interesting thing that happened is that each one of them, like Sandra Day O'Connor or Al Gore, became involved with the project. And I'll tell you about Sandra Day O'Connor very soon because it's very relevant, and she makes a lot of video games at her 81 to 86. And actually, there was a big story in the New York Times just this month about her civic education games. We'll talk about them. Another thing that you do is you need to be legit, right? You need legitimacy. You need to partner with organizations that have that. And one of them is Tribeca, the film festival, because film, it doesn't suffer from the same childhood illnesses that games have. So we started to be, 2 years ago, we started to be part of Tribeca, and that introduced us to the whole, you know, new audience. This is Robert. The other thing that happened with Tribeca is the public arcade. That was an amazing experience to bring those games to the street and seeing people react to them, because again, the perception of people is so narrow about what, not everyone, but a lot, especially those that don't play games regularly. They think that games are one thing, and then suddenly they go with their kids and they see those educational games and they become very, very excited about it. Another thing that happened, Games for Change became a category. They didn't even tell us, they just announced it. It became a category in the Game Awards of the video game industry. So that was a moment. It's still a niche, it's still like a small thing, but you know, that's a recognition from the kind of commercial industry. The last thing that happened, how many people here heard about Gamergate? So another bookmark, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, it's pretty complex. But it's basically a whole war that started in the last year, being led by a few very brave women that started to speak about equality and representation and gender in the gaming industry. And a very vocal and aggressive group of male gamers started to fight back, and very aggressively to a level of death threats and rape threats and putting their information out there in the world, including social security and addresses. And Anita Sarkisian is one of those heroes. But it was really, it was a fight that, you know, at the time it was very disturbing to see. But if you take a step back, it was, for me, it was a good sign because it shows you that this medium is going to change no matter what. And the people that are fighting, they're just, you know, they have no chance to win it because young designers and young makers are coming in. I want to speak now about impact with games, and I'm going to go to show you a few other cases of what you could do with video games today and what people are doing that when I made Peacemaker, I couldn't even imagine. So what I'm going to show you now is work that people in the community did. The reason I call it typology is because very recently we started to classify what impact could be done with games. And what you're seeing today is a draft, it's a sketch, it's very early in the process. But what we started doing is putting those categories together. And the reason to put the categories is also to understand that if you make a game and your goal, like Peacemaker, for example, is to raise awareness, it's a very different goal from someone who makes a game to teach someone skills or knowledge. And not only that it's different discipline, it also means that you're going to work with different experts. And it's going to mean, it also means that you're going to measure it in completely different ways. So the categories that we put for now in our draft, work in progress, one is learning, pretty straightforward, okay? I'm going to show an example with Sandra Day O'Connor. But the idea that you teach someone. Second one is about awareness. I have a spotlight. It's more about communication. It's more about campaigning. And I direct the spotlight to something. So it's not necessarily that I'm going to teach you about women empowerment issues. You're not going to become an expert, but you're going to become aware that that exists. Maybe you become aware what you could do to help. The third one is about social movements. How do you get people together and get networks to work together. And this is very specific to games because of location-based, mobility. It could be very interesting. I'll show you one example today. And the next one is about, you heard the word gamification, the idea that you take something that exists and you basically use gaming elements or gaming to enhance it, to motivate people. You know, the most basic example of this is that you collect points for your Visa card or flights, right? You collect miles. It's a game, right? There are levels, there is progress. This is a very basic, primitive version. But I'll show you some very interesting example. Behavior change is very ambitious. It's the idea that I actually influence someone not only to think differently, I'm going to make him act in a certain way. And the last one, which is really brand new, you're the first one that I'm actually even showing it to, neurotraining, games that actually change the state of the brain in real time. Okay, it's not about, you know, I'm going to show you and to give you an experience that is going to change how you think about something or even how you act. I'm going to change your brain structure, and I'm going to deal with, for example, cognitive deficits in real time, like medicine almost. Okay, I'll show you something and hopefully it will be clear. The first one that I want to show you is iCivics. So I told you about Sandra Day O'Connor. She decided to make video games. She started an NGO. It's called iCivics. So far, they made 21 games that are played in half of the schools in America. Okay? They achieved it by doing it for many years. That's one of the most sustainable and interesting projects out there. You can play the president. You can go to certain games and learn about the court system. They made a game about Congress. Another thing that they achieved by doing it for so many years is that they really built a whole curriculum, right? They can start to see where are the holes, and they create another game and another game. So a very, very robust and interesting project. Obviously, the name of Sandra Day O'Connor helped there. But again, you can't suspect Sandra Day O'Connor to be a gamer. What happened there is that she spoke about her grandkids and the level of immersion and engagement that they have. And she said, look, I don't need research, even though there is a lot of research. But she said, I don't need research. I just watch them. And I want them to play those games because civic education is fading out. It's boring. People are disengaged. I want them to be re-engaged with it. The example of raising awareness is an example that I like a lot. Dumb Ways to Die. How many people know it? Okay, I'm going to show you a clip. It's a campaign that was done in Melbourne but became a global phenomena with the millions of players. The video clip that I'm going to show you now was watched by more than 126 million views. The interesting thing about it is how creative it is. I can't imagine the MTA in New York doing something like this. The idea that in order to tell people to be safe around the subway, you give them all the other stupid ways you can die from. Okay, so this is Dumb Ways to Die, and it has a series of games on the phone that you can play. They're very cool.
Set fire to your hair, poke a stick at a grizzly bear, eat medicine that's out of date, use your private parts as piranha bait. Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die. Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die. Get your toast out with a fork, do your own electrical work, teach yourself how to fly, eat a 2-week-old unrefrigerated pie. Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die. Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die. Invite a psycho killer inside, scratch a drug dealer's brand new. Your helmet off in outer space, use a clothes, dry your ass, a hiding place.
Dumb ways to die.
What's this red button do?
Dumb ways to die. So many dumb ways to die. Dumb ways to die. So many dumb ways to die.
Dress up like a moose during hunting season. Disturb a nest of wasps for no good reason. Stand on the edge of a train station platform. Drive around the boom gates at a level crossing. Run across the tracks between the platforms. They may not rhyme, but they're quite possibly. Be safe around trains, a message from Metro.
So think about what this does to a brand, you know, to an organization in terms of perception and connection with the young generation. In terms of social movements, this is something that I think will interest you. And by the way, I'm not going over, I mean, we can share the deck later with all those evaluation sound bites and links, but it was a very interesting experiment by the Knight Foundation, and they went with a very creative game company. They had two communities in Macon, Georgia. One of them mostly African-American, one of them mostly white. And they wanted to do two things in terms of, let's call it, impact objectives. They wanted to get the communities to work together, but they also wanted to support local businesses. What they did was very creative because it's mostly non-digital. They created those bonds, like new currency. They partner with the local businesses to acknowledge and recognize that money as real money. And the idea is that people from both communities need to find each other and make the money a whole and go to the local business. Okay? So they created those ties, but they also created this awareness to those new businesses that they wanted to promote. The only digital component of this game was a platform that people could find each other. You know, I could take a photo of my half and show it. Another pretty stunning example is we talked about gamification, how you take an existing program or service. This is a science project made by a scientist that was working on folding proteins. I'm not a scientist. But what I understand is that folding proteins leads to great discoveries in science, including things that help to cure HIV/AIDS and cancer. And until that time that this guy came in, it was done by supercomputers. So supercomputers can make multiple calculations very fast, and they try to fold those proteins to the right solutions, right? It's almost like a puzzle. And this guy said, why not making a game? Think about it, by the way, in the peace context, how interesting it could be. Why not make a game? I'll put it out there. We'll get thousands and thousands of people to play it, and maybe they will solve it. Who knows, you know? Maybe they'll do something that a supercomputer cannot do. So he took a specific problem that was very known in the science community, and he put it out there, and it was a problem that the supercomputer could not solve for 10 years. How long it took the players? 10 days. So this is from Time magazine. Now, we're not talking here about the simulation. This is like a real science problem. So it actually became a Nature publication. And the players, because they felt that it's such a community thing, didn't want their names there. So I think it says folded players in the author's line. And it spawned, I mean, a whole genre of things like this. There are now games that help with understanding optic nerves and reading old maps and doing a lot of tasks that people, you know, on a mask can do, and sometimes very creatively. Behavior change. Believe it or not, the game Remission made at Hope Lab in Silicon Valley. By the way, they're very good at not only making good products, but also doing very deep research to a level of medical research. So those guys made a game for young patients, and what they wanted to do is two things. They wanted them to understand what's going on in their body, but they also wanted to connect between what's going on in the body and the medicine that they take. So with young patients, especially many of you that work in that field probably know that, there is a whole compliance issue. You know, it's not that they don't think the medicine works, but, you know, they tend to forget, or maybe they go to sleep at the girlfriend's house or the boyfriend and they forget the medicine. So this game, not only that it improved the understanding of the disease, they actually were much more consistent if you compare them to a control group that didn't play the games. And the other amazing thing is that it stayed for a very long term. Even though they played for 2 weeks, you could see the effect 6 months later. This is, by the way, kind of scratching the surface of brain research and seeing what areas in the brain are being activated by playing a game versus other forms of media. The last one that I mentioned with the brain, this is another story that got to Nature, was on the cover of Nature. Adam Gazzelli from San Francisco, a scientist, again, not a game designer, one day he said that he got this idea in a dream. He decided that his life project, which is helping seniors with mental decline, could be solved with a video game. So he had this idea that he will create this racing game, and the players, the seniors, will need to do two things. One is to navigate the car, but also they need to respond to signs. And he designed it in a particular way that only he can do because he understands what happens in the brain, and he knew that those specific activities are going to improve multitasking. But he also hoped that there's going to be a transference to other things that will help mental decline, like memory and those functions in the brain. And again, he discovered that not only that it's helping for seniors, it's also something that stays for a long term. He again saw the six-month period that this was effective. And you can see it again. This is medical publication. This is not a game industry thing. And I'll tell you very soon about what's next with neurotraining and Adam's work. So what's next? This is the first time I'm talking about it. It was also the brief I got when I came to speak. What really is on the horizon? Like, and what things people like yourself that are interested in peace studies, in compassion, in empathy, you know, what's more exciting even from some of the exciting stuff I showed you and I'm very thrilled about. I think that what's next is even more promising, and it's related to technology. The first one, let's stay on neuroscience, okay? So what Adam Gazzelli did after he did this game for seniors, he said, why not take this method, take it to the commercial world, let's get an FDA approval, let's expand it to other conditions like ADHD, like anxiety, like depression, and get to a place where one day a doctor will prescribe a video game and will basically give someone a tablet, will tell them, go home, play it for 3 weeks, maybe an hour a day, come back to me, give me the tablet back, and you don't need to take any medicine because I call it digital medicine. So, sounds like science fiction, but this company raised $30 million 2 months ago, and it's pretty advanced in the FDA approval process. So they're on a very promising track with it. Second area, virtual reality. I mean, you knew that we were going to get to virtual reality at the end. Virtual reality is interesting because it gets to the experience. How many of you tried virtual reality so far? Okay, so there is definitely a gap of time until it's going to become mainstream consumer facing, and people are going to use it like we use any mobile. But the level of immersiveness and the illusion that you're in another place is so strong that it can do things like what I'm going to show you now. Snow World is a virtual reality experience that was created for people that suffer from severe burns.
I was on fire. I couldn't see to unbuckle my seatbelt or open the door. I believe my guardian angel just took me out of the truck.
First Lieutenant Samuel Brown survived an attack on his Humvee in southern Afghanistan, but he would then have to endure rounds of surgery, skin grafts, and painful skin stretching.
This is a battle that's going to take years to get back to being how it was prior to this.
But while Brown's body fights that battle, virtual reality technology lets his brain enjoy hurling snowballs to the music of Paul Simon. University of Washington researchers Hunter Hoffman and David Patterson designed the virtual reality game Snow World to occupy burn patients' minds during painful wound cleaning or physical
therapy. So the thing is that it's not only about the distraction. What they showed that it actually achieves pain reduction. Like what they showed in their medical research is that, you know, it achieved a pain reduction sometimes in places that other methods couldn't. The other thing that I want to show you that is much more relevant to the world that we're talking about is, many of you might have heard about it. It's a movie made by the UN. Unfortunately, I cannot show it in virtual reality, but I have this interactive video here that, and the idea is that they put you in a Syrian refugee camp with a virtual reality helmet. And it's not only watching a video, you can actually look around. And it's telling the story of one of those refugees. And you can, you know, you go to the bakery and you can, you know, you look down, you look up. And it's probably better than any other method to get you into that experience and being in a completely different place. It's not a shortcut. I mean, most chances are, maybe some of you are actually doing that work, but most chances that a regular person is not going to find himself in that refugee camp in the near future. So this is one of those projects, and a lot of filmmakers are now... this is, by the way, interesting about virtual reality, that I see how game makers are in a gold rush, but also filmmakers are in a gold rush. And those two disciplines that sometimes never really communicate with each other are kind of finding themselves working on the same medium. One with more like animation and 3D, and one with live action. Okay, the last example. Esports. How many of you heard about electronic sports? Okay, the number of hands from one to the next is... No, but a nice number there, and especially young. What you see in those two images is Madison Square Garden. It's a project that I was lucky to be part of, as helping Tribeca. And Tribeca and Madison Square Garden are now equal partners. And they came to us after we started the partnership with Games for Change and said, you know, what we can do in gaming that, you know, is also a bit more commercial or kind of consumer-facing, and, you know, we have this amazing venue, that, you know, the NBA plays in, and it has the Rangers in hockey. And we said, oh, esports, of course. Esports is the idea that people play video games competitively like a sport. They play for money. Thousands of people watch them in the arena, while millions, literally millions, are watching them online. The last World Championship of League of Legends had 32 million unique viewers, which is larger than NBA Finals. And it's still in a crazy growth mode. So we came to Madison Square Garden and we said, let's bring League of Legends. It's the number one game in the world. And we convinced League of Legends to do that. Madison Square Garden were completely unsure, what are we talking about? What do you mean, video game? And, but what you're seeing now is an actual, by the way, it was sold out in 24 hours. And what you see is a video game played on the screens there. You see the five against five, the two teams, but all the other people you see are people that are just watching. I'm going to show you a quick video just that you understand the level of engagement.
Gentlemen, we are in Madison Square Garden. How does it feel?
It's a really cool experience to have every person around you like the thing that you like.
It really has changed my life. I absolutely love this game.
It's one of those games that, whether we're having a good day or a bad day, we know if we play, we're going to have a good time and we're going to be better off for it.
Okay, so that's esports. And now they have those teams, they have coaches, they are special broadcasters, commentators, there are special leagues. And the reason that I'm showing you esports, because to me, even though, unlike the other things I showed you, it's not exactly about social good, but to me it's a very good sign when we break the virtual screens and it's no longer that isolated. And it's such a social cultural phenomena for people celebrating what they like in a setting like this. You know, if people are worried that video games are going to disconnect people, this is an amazing example for, you know, just like the Olympics or big sport competitions, it brings people together around their passion. And think about this power and what we could do around peace and other, you know, things of that nature. This is my last slide. I call it your game here because even if you're not a game maker, even if you're not ever going to design a game, I think that there are many ways to get involved, whether by funding those things. I mean, I spoke with many brave funders that it was the first time they ever funded the video game, whether you can support it in other ways, whether you can be the expert that helps the game to have accurate content. So thank you very much, guys.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.